Now, shall we begin on to talk about applications of computers? Now, you probably already have understood that this course is a large number of anecdotes from my experience about how science and engineering runs. And in fact, that is what the course amounts to. It amounts to all the things that I think you ought to know about, but is not taught in normal course. This one begins with a story that about 50, mid-50s, something like that, I discovered I was extremely nervous addressing large audiences. Now, I taught in college, so I was used to talking, but big audiences frightened me. Now, a function of the scientist is to communicate. There are written books and written articles. There are formal talks, and there are informal, quick talks. You should master all three. If you're going to create something, there is an obligation on your part to communicate. A large number of people don't do this. I felt the necessity, so I said I'd do something about it. Now, let me first talk about the informal talks. I have quite a few of my friends at Bell Labs who are what I call backroom scientists. They're invited to a conference. We're going to make a decision about whether we're going to build it this way or that way. We make the decision. We go ahead. 2 weeks later, they issue a memorandum about why we should have done something else. It would be desirable for them to stand at that moment and say, you are doing it wrong for these reasons, bing, 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 bing. This ability to talk at the drop of a hat and give a very good, clear explanation is very necessary in this age of group activities. When a committee is meeting or something, you have got to be able to speak up promptly and to the point and carry conviction. Now, the other one's a little more troublesome, particularly the large speech. I said, well, you've got to do something about it, Hammond. You cannot become a great scientist if you cannot communicate well. It's one of the necessary things. So I said, I've got to learn. I've got practice. I have to accept giving talks, even though I don't like to. Well, shortly afterwards, I was asked if somebody from IBM was probably give a talk one night in New York to a group who were studying. Now, I knew what that was because what they normally do is they get a bunch of people, say, people who are learning a new machine or something, and they have some of them in New York. Monday night, they have a get-together party. Tuesday night, maybe they give tickets to a theater. Thursday night, maybe they have a lecture or something. But they have a problem entertaining the people for 4 nights in New York. And one of the things is this kind of a talk on computers. Well, I didn't know exactly what it was, but I wanted to give a talk so good that I'd be asked to give it again so I get more practice. Well, the first thing you think you're going to do in those circumstances is talk something you are very, very interested in and you are expert in. That's not the way to get invited again. You'd better start asking what is it they want to hear. Now, I'm not talking entertainment. I have a friend in computing who spent so much of his time being entertained, he was glad he pushed down the computing field. I am talking about communicating what are topics other people want to hear. So I thought for a long while, now this is in the 50s, and I came up with the title, The History of Computing to the Year 2000. It was going to be interesting to me. Now, furthermore, I had the feature, which I point out to you. It meant that as years went on, I gave a talk again and again and again, I had always to keep track of what was happening and look at what the new things that might be possible. It kept me acutely aware of the future possibilities of computing. It kept my attention on that matter. It was just the kind of thing I should do. And one of the things I want to summarize at this point, when you give talks, when possible, you should profit by it also. It worked out very well. I gave the talk. They said, like very well. And I said, well, I'll be glad I couldn't do it again. And sure enough, I used to go about 3 times a year for maybe 6 or 8 years and give such talks. I got all the practice I wanted. But you see, it also did this other thing for me. When I use the expression frequently, luck favors the prepared mind, which is a remark of Pasteur, and I believe in, you see, in some extent, I was making my luck. I found all was wanted. Now, the first time I gave a talk was on computers. I turned up, which is really the talk 2 times ago, except I had gorgeously prepared slides with curves for noise and curves for uncertainty quantum principles and such other things. Beautifully done. Very convincing. But you notice I didn't use them to you. I finally found out, saying, come on, think about the size of molecules. Think about impurities. Think about how fast velocity light goes. Think about heat. And you see the nature of the problem without any elaborate quantum mechanical curves, which you probably didn't understand anyhow. I reduced it down to things you could understand. Well, I gave a talk a couple of times. I began to realize that the future was not limited by the machines. It was limited by the software. So I started giving a talk on hardware and software. But after a while, I came to the realization that, while not completely true, a great deal depends upon economics, but applications. That is going to control the development of machines. So I had to do this third talk. So the talk gradually moved from one to three different things, all because I said to myself, I have to learn to be able to give public talks. So, now, computer began as simple arithmetic. At Los Alamos, we were just grinding out numbers for atomic bomb design, just numbers, 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 and it was only one letter. We named the designs by letters of the alphabet. So there was a letter P on the problem one, all those cars involved with problem P. There was a Q on all those. Outside that, it's all numbers. And this was generally how you think about it. But if you go back to something like 1300, there was a guy named Raymond Lull, or Lully, which is the way you want to spell it. He lived on Menorca. He was a Franciscan, I think. And he had the idea of building a logic machine. It's a screwy idea. Now, if you will read, as you probably have, Swift's Gulliver's Travels, what you possibly don't know, that it's a tremendous parody on everything. The people who break their eggs at one end or the other were one of the political parties or the other political party. The whole business of the island of Laputa is exactly a spoof on Lowe. Raymond Lowe's idea that you can build a machine which will do thinking for you. So it does go very far back, 1300, this problem about the middle of his life, and it isn't the first time. On the other hand, we began by number crunching, pure and simple, because they were the only people who could afford the bill. Machines were expensive, and there was no other way of doing it. As machines became cheaper, we started doing other things. Now you see word processor. Now when I see a personal computer at somebody's office sitting idle, I cannot help but think, my God, if we had had that back then, what computing I could have done with all that idle time. Machines become so cheap, they're like telephones. They're idle most of the time, right? In the early days, no. My bosses used to want to know what fraction of time I was running. I was up sometimes to 97% efficiency throughout the week. And I argue them, look, that's not the way to run computing. It's machine efficient but human inefficient. I pointed at a telephone and I got brushed off on that one, so I made another study. I studied men's johns. And I came to one conference that I've made a study of men's johns, and there's always some capacity for somebody. I've never seen a john which there was not some capacity. You put in sufficient capacity so that people don't have to wait. Don't you need to do the same for computing? It's pretty much the same stuff. They argued that it was a legal requirement, but I got the point across, that it was foolish to have machines work close to maximum efficiency. It's tremendously inefficient for humans. And we've got now down to almost the opposite. Personal computers operate a very low fraction of time. They sit out of waiting field. So we got some progress there, and we shifted around. Now, I want to tell you another aspect of the problem, which you will meet in varying forms. At Los Alamos, we were solving a large partial differential equation on relays. When I went to Bell Labs, one of the first problems I solved on the VA computers for Aberdeen was a big problem, partial differential equation on design of relays. I actually solved a partial differential integral equation on our accounting department equipment. In short, I did very difficult problems on relay computers. When we got better computers, I was reduced to doing trajectories of guided missiles, trajectories to the moon, and such other things, which are ordinary differential equations, and are much easier. some years later, I wrote a couple papers on trajectories. I wrote a couple papers on just how to integrate. Then I wrote a paper on how do you evaluate a function. And finally, I wrote a classic paper on how do numbers actually combine. With the most difficult equipment, with the most primitive equipment, I was asked to do the most difficult jobs. At the back end, with the very advanced equipment, I was doing simple jobs. Now, this is what happens to any new idea. If you have a new idea which is going to influence your organization, you're going to have to demonstrate it will work under the most difficult conditions, the worst possible ones. When you finally get it installed, the bulk of the time will be spent on much simpler ones. But somehow or other, there's a very, very big impedance that people demand that you be able to do the worst, most difficult things first. Then you get around to do the ones you want to do or should be doing. I tell you this because on numerous occasions I've faced the thing and I've had to take action. You want to size up the opposition, and there are times when it's better to abandon the idea and go do something else. And I'll stick one more of those stories in along the way, if I remember to do it, on exactly my doing that kind of a thing. Now, very early after I got started, I realized I was in the mass production of a variable product. That's exactly how I said it. I am trying to set up the situation so I can do all of next year's proposed problems. I don't know what they're going to be, but they're going to fall in certain categories. How do I do it? And I told you with the 650, I spent one man year, which would be several people working parallel for maybe 4 months, to get the software system going. Within a year, I had more work done than I ever would have gotten done if I'd brought out the problem straightforward. In short, it paid me to build a software tool. But beware. The machine 650 didn't stay around more than 2.5 years before something else came along. If you try to build some software and you're going to get paid back for it, you'd better get those savings within a year and a half, or you're likely not to get the savings. We are living in changing time. These ideas don't last long. And so you've got to get your money on software. But it pays to build tools. Everybody knows it pays to take time to build a tool, and building a software tool for the 650 greatly increased the amount of work I could do in 1 year. Now, I've ignored much later in the lectures. I'll talk about one where I did a large business job for AT&T renting a UNIVAC in New York City. So I will do some, but fundamentally I'm concerned with engineering problems. And what I observed, time versus the large amount of operations, it was a curve research was bending over. Now, you've seen why curves bend over. There's a saturation point. Two reasons. One is that given 1,000 scientists, just how many problems can they ask per day and still be scientists? There's a limit to how much they can ask. Now, they can ask for bigger problems, but the number of problems they can ask is quite limited. They can't absorb the answers. They can't think that much. So it curved up and started bending over. But I spread out the work gradually to engineering. After all, as part of Bell Labs, and there's a whole Bell Labs engineering part, 90% was the engineering, 10% was research. So I found a load engineering coming up like this. And remembering this is logarithm, that's a great deal larger. And we have a military location at Cliffney, New Jersey, which is devoted mainly to military problems in the past. I don't know what it's doing now. And they came along like that. Now, the result was I saw the straight line growth. After that came word processing, which, as you know, occupies an enormous amount of time. Your compiler, when you use a Fortran compiler or your assembler, your monitor system, all the symbol manipulating things, they're not doing any scientific computing at all, they're just throwing symbols around. And I think we'll go on and find pattern recognition as a large consumer of computing. I don't think you can solve the general pattern recognition problem because it's too difficult. But a great many pattern recognition problems will probably be done by machine. And you also find that, say, virtual reality, which requires enormous amount of computing, will absorb a great deal of computing time, a great deal of computing power. So the curve is not over with. It's still going to go, but we are beginning to saturate by non-impact machines and having to go to parallel processing to do it. Well, let me talk about another episode, Jack King. He was a guy at Bell Labs, and he was crazy in the sense that I could prove he was crazy. He was at one time more like that, and I get a letter from Alan Ben, and I can prove he's crazy. But that's beside the point. He had an idea of connecting a new machine, a scientific data systems machine, to the cyclotron at Brookhaven, which we were using, to reduce data on the fly. Well, Jack was clearly crazy. And my vice president stopped in the hall one day and said, look, he says, Kane thinks he can do these things. You know something about computers. Will you please investigate and tell me whether you think this can be done? Because it's a very novel idea, don't you? So I call up Jack, and we go to lunch frequently, and I begin to find out, yes, he's crazy, but he's got good ideas. And I look at the machine, and I report back to my vice president, yes, with some guidance from me, Jack Kane can do that job if you give him the machine. Then the vice president said to me, I don't want to get a machine from fly-by-night company we will be gone next week. Are those people likely to stay in business? That's not in my field of mathematics, mind you, but it's a question which he asks, I must answer, right? It happens that I know slightly the president. And so, having first studied the question, gone to IBM and asked a lot of pointed questions about their manufacturing and so on, and studied some books in economics, I make an appointment with Max Pilevsky saying, I would like to meet you out in your office at such a date about 10 o'clock. I want to talk about your company and getting a machine because there's some doubt that the company will be in business long. So I walk into his office, we are polite, and I say to him pointedly, right out, the major cost for failures in this business is not enough capital. Have you got enough money? He laid it out beautifully. I asked him further pointed questions. He gave answers beautifully. We walked down the production line. I inspected, had a look at IBM and some other ones, and it looked good. So I reported back, yep, we could. We got the machine, and with some guidance from me, Jack installed it, and that guy was working great. Well, comes now another part. We are also using a Van de Graaff at Rutgers, which is pretty much the same, the odd particle accelerator, and we want to put a machine on that. Well, we had originally gotten the smallest machine which would do the job, and of course, when you get the smallest machine, we had had a lot of trouble making it work. I thought we'd try this little better machine, and this time it's in the matter of hands, not of the vice president, but in head of the department head who's in charge of that kind of stuff. And I'm in his office one day, and I say, well, when are you going to make up your mind about getting which machine? And he says to me, I'm going to decide when all the department is agreed which machine. I looked at him and said, you mean you're going to settle for the stupidest mind of the bunch? I walked out and never went back. Now, I had a lovely job at Bell Labs like that. I stuck myself, my nose in the business, which wasn't needed, and I walked off. Now, sometimes my boss assigned me jobs, but fundamentally, I was in that position. And when I saw the opposition was that much, I walked off. I decided there were other things I could do which were more constructive than fighting a guy who wants to settle for the stupidest mind. Now, once we did these couple, we naturally wanted to put computers in Bell Labs to do laboratory work, too. After all, these little small computers were just coming in, and personal computers, which were often kits you bought and assembled for yourself, but there were a few ones that you could buy already assembled. So we started doing this to reduce the data in the various experiments right on the fly, because my arithmetic suggested that the one at Brookhaven probably doubled the capacity of the machine because when the data was reduced on the fly, you noticed that it wasn't quite enough counts. Oh, the damn sample must not be in the middle of the beam. We cut off the power, we go in, we adjust the thing, we come back out, we hang up the keys, we turn the juice on again, and sure enough. Or, there's something funny happening at the end of that spectrum, we better get some more cell up there, we go back, slightly change the experiment, and resume. We caught runs early that were going to be no good, whereas they used to run 18 hours and then look at the data. And of course, frequently, these 18 hours were wasted. That's how I think we doubled the capacity of the machine. Well, when we put these in Bell Labs, Bell Labs being electronic heavily, there has to be, for an experiment, a bunch of electrical stimuli. And people quickly learn that if they put a digital analog thing on the end, the machine could generate the input stimuli. So we started doing that. We put the stimuli into stimulus, like sequence of square pulses, or a square pulse followed by a sinusoid. We could put in these signals very easily. But once you have the signals in, the data you see up, you're ready to close the loop and get a feedback system. Now you're in a position quite different. You can let the machine, while experimenting, then adjust itself for what you want. Now, I tell this story because this is what happens with machines in the past. We got them for one reason. We promptly used them for other ones. The presence of the machine changed the job, and we could respond with general-purpose machines to the changed situation. When you get special-purpose machines, you cannot do that trick anywhere near as well. And I was greatly impressed with how many people got machines in and how that changed it. In fact, the whole psychology department finally got a glorious big machine in with a large number of terminals, and they only did interactive experiments. Like shining a light on a person's eye to ball to watch how the iris grew, and then changing the signal and watching the frequency which the eyeball could respond to or not, trying to probe what was the feedback mechanism in the brain that controlled these things. Because if you've got the frequency response, you have some idea, if it's a linear system, what the mechanism is, what the feedback paths are, and so on. We started doing a large number of these interactive experiments and proved to be very, very useful. The social science department was one of the most active. Now, I want to go on to something, another topic along the way. The same vice president asked me, he said, some people at Boeing, Seattle, are going to ask you to come out and spend 2 weeks looking at the community center. It might be a nice thing if you went. Now, he didn't order me to go. He never did that. But I got the message, and so when they called up, I agreed. I was in for a surprise. I thought I was going out there, the guy was invited me, to inspect how well they were doing computing, managing machines. Well, the first day, Monday, he's escorting me around. Suddenly, I am sidetracked by his vice president, separated from him, taken into a room, which a large number of vice presidents and some of the board of directors are there, and said, what we want to know is this guy doing a good job or not? Not how we treat you up a deer. I gulped 6 times and thought about walking out, and I said, no, my vice president probably knew that was a job. He just didn't want to tell me in advance. So I'm probably doing the job he wants, so I guess I'll have to do it. Well, the first thing I found out was that Boeing kept a record of the current design of the airplane on tape. Now you keep it on a disc. And the idea was very simple. We shall use that, and everybody will be compatible all the time. It didn't take me very long to find out that was not what happened. It cannot happen. Suppose you're in the wing design department. If you are trying to make small changes here, there, and yon to see if the flight is better, and if somebody over there changes something over there, you may see something better when your new design was worse, right? What you do is you make a copy of that tape, and you use that tape unchanged by anybody else until you get your design perfected, because you cannot do an optimization design if the constants you are using are constantly changing. No way. When they got it done, then they would try to integrate it with the rest of the plane. Now, I think the vice presidents thought that the tape was being used, but every group, in fact, did something quite different. They got a copy, they used what they could, they froze on that one until the fish optimization was done, and then it was integrated back in. You can see why it has to happen. Now, it brings up databases in general. Databases are a very, very difficult topic. Every damn big executive I've ever met, like he felt, if only he had the complete state of the company every moment, he could make better decisions. Well, let's ask the question, a brutal one. If the decision is going to depend upon moment-to-moment data, is that a decision a president or board of directors should make? They should be concerned with long-term effects, which should not depend upon moment-to-moment situations. Right? Therefore, that idea they have that they can manage better, yes, they can micromanage better, but they really should not be making important decisions based on moment to moment. Those decisions should be made at a lower level, by far. And in some companies, they finally were. So the idea that you have a company database is not such a red-hot idea as you might think. It doesn't get too well. Now, one other feature bad, suppose you and I are both vice presidents of the company, and there's going to be a meeting Monday morning, and so you go in Friday afternoon and run the programs to get the results. And you have a graph showing what's going to happen. But I, knowing a great deal of data comes in over the weekends, because telephone lines are cheaper then, I go in Sunday night using exactly the same programs but a different database, and I come up with different conclusions. We walk in the present, you have one set of curves, I have a certain other set. It is not tolerable. It is not a reasonable way to operate a company. So the idea that I can have a rapidly changing database and use it to make high-level decisions is a very, very dubious proposition. But what about scientific databases? So you have a scientific database, and there's a velocity of light in it. And somebody in your organization makes a new measurement of velocity of light. He wants his in. There's going to be a great deal of wasted company time as to who gets whose velocity of light in the damn thing. Furthermore, if the velocity of light is changing, I'm making some studies, my program calls for C shows a change. Not from what I'm doing in case to case, because somebody changed the velocity of light. Again, I can't use even in science a constantly changing database if I want to optimize and do such studies, which is what we almost always are doing. So while it's a very nice idea, it doesn't work out so well in practice. Now, you can all, of course, do what the computing center did at Bell Labs for a while. Every change you was set out, change notice to all the users. As a result, you got two or three change notices a day in software, this or that, the other. You're busy working, you don't read the damn things. Now, suddenly, when you do something new, it doesn't work. The center says, oh, we told you 6 weeks ago about that change. But you weren't paying attention to that. Then you were applying to something else. Blaming the user for not paying attention does not decrease the wasted time of the company. It's no use trying to pin it down. You can see again that that kind of method isn't going to work if changes are made too rapidly. The user simply cannot keep up. Now, I began by talking about general purpose machines, but I'm glad you're talking about special purpose ones. Now, one of the first times a general-purpose machine was built, in a sense, was back Intel. Intel, in the very early days of integrated circuits, had three or four different jobs. And somebody said, you know, if I built a four-bit general-purpose computer and programmed it, I could do all these four different problems by different programs. So I'll make one production line done of all of these, and simply write different programs, and I'll be able to supply the chips for all four ones with only one production run instead of four. Well, it wasn't very long before 4 bits could be made, because 4 bits computers are awful small. Well, it went from 8 for a while, 16, 32, now you'll have 64-bit computers for a chip, right? But it started when a guy had a bunch of special-purpose ones, and he backed off and said, I can do the whole bunch with one general-purpose approach rather than special-purpose all the time. Now, you tend not to realize how many computers you operate with, stop and go signs. In your car, even now, there are computers trying to regulate the mixture of gas and air and so on your carburetor. There are various timing things and so on are being operated by computers, your personal computers. A vast number of things are being operated by computers. Washing machine, my wife's dish dryer, dishwasher and dryer. It's got a small chip in there. We have them all over the place, and you're going to see many, many more. The difficulty is, of course, that if the washing machine goes out, that chip has got to be replaced. It's got to be found from one place. It's not a general-purpose chip generally, and it suffers from that case. It wouldn't cost the manufacturer much more at all to put in a general-purpose chip instead. But the egotism, as I told you before, of a special-purpose chip is very, very high, and I warn you extremely loudly against the dangers of special-purpose chips. Now, I don't have to tell you what the application of computers are in your business. You ought to know it better than I do. But they're going to spread. And they're going to spread for the reasons I gave you at the end of one of the earlier lectures: cheaper, faster, freedom from boredom. Also, if you manage it all, you know the role of personnel problems. Well, computers don't have to have sick leave. They go to the repair shop if they have that. They don't have to go home because their grandmother died. They don't have to have pensions. They don't have to have recreation. They don't have to have all kinds of things that humans have to have. Therefore, you will see more and more done by machines. Now, a robot, in my estimation, is something which handles things in the material world. It doesn't have to have wheels or legs and arms, although you may think that way early. It's anything that handles things in the material world, like picking up chips and turning them over. It's very, very hard for machines to cope with the real world. It's very hard to write programs for them. That's why I told you the other day, when in my youth we had screws and nuts and bolts to assemble things, now you have rivets and welding. Building a machine which will put a nut on a bolt isn't as easy as you think. You just watch several times how, when it gets stuck, what you do, and how you get a nut to go onto a bolt. You'll decide that you don't want to write that program after a while. It will work on a lot of them, but it's got to work on every damn one. That's why we're at the other things. It's not too nice, but that's what we did. Now, the range of applications in your business probably is only beginning. In mine, science is going a long way because that's where it started by and large. We have probably a better idea of our future than you have of yours, and our future is not very clear. The possibilities of machines are very, very large indeed. They're a very awkward topic. Now, when you leave your careers, I want you to look at what were the cases which succeeded in using computers and which ones didn't, and why didn't they? Because this is going to be a major problem you're going to face. Do you recognize this or that? People will tell you, older officers, that it must be done this way. There must be a man with a gun doing this and so on. It cannot be done by machine. Blah, blah, blah. My advice is, if a person is too insistent, you walk off and go do something else. Almost all the past doctrine of how things must be done is not right. I told you the story when I suggested 1 out of 10 experiments were done in the lab on my machine, 9 out of 10 in the lab, and we reversed. 9 out of 10 would be in my machine, 1 out of 10 in the lab. Management knew I was wrong. I was a crazy, long-haired theoretician. I was dead right. They were wrong, and they spent an enormous amount of money because they could not understand that what was happening was we were changing the nature of science. And we're changing the nature of your business. The nature of being changed. But the older people cannot apparently absorb this. And so you, as younger one, you have to be patient with these older people. After all, they know how they got to the top. And that must be the right way. It was the right way when they did it. But it isn't the right way now. And it won't be the right way tomorrow. So anything I can tell you how to succeed today will not be appropriate to your career tomorrow. You have to find out. But I guarantee you a large amount of machines will be coming into your business. Now, one of the things they are doing is, I find very interesting, they are teaching us about ourselves. We are learning amazing about ourselves. For example, in programming, we are learning how little we know about language. There were very early proposals and attempts, lots of money spent on translating Russian to English. We found out we don't know how language runs. We don't know how anything. For example, I'm trying to get some ideas in your head. There's some meaning what I'm talking about. I do not know the meaning of the word meaning. I don't think you do either. You know until I ask you. It's like, I think I told you the story. St. Augustine says, I know what time it is until you ask me, then I don't know. I know what I mean by meaning until I ask. And then I found I don't know. And therefore, I cannot write a program which will deal with meaning. I can write programs that deal with symbols. I can do other things. But this elusive thing, meaning, I have the idea. You can't say what they mean. No way. When you get the idea finally or something, it is one molecule flips over this way. Now you've got the idea. It isn't that simple. Whatever you mean by, oh, now I've got the idea. Now, at lunch today, I was discussing with my friend. I picked him, by the way, because he looks like he's the person I had lunch with. And you think, when you talk about this point, I said, well, how do I measure whether the student has the idea in a calculus course of integration by parts? What I do is give him 3 or 4 problems and see if he solves them pretty much the way I would, in which case I say he's got the same idea. That's not proof, but that's the evidence we use, isn't it? So we think the other person has the idea or the understanding when, under particular tests, they seem to behave the same as we would. So we don't know what meaning is, but we have a way of coping with it, which is not too good. I ask 3 or 4 questions on integration by parts, and the student either gets them or he doesn't. But that doesn't mean he understands it. I've only got a sample of 4 out of hundreds of thousands possible. So it's a very difficult question. Now, our previous 2 ones, I talked a great deal about the future of the hardware, what the limitations were, and I talked a little bit about the future of software and the problems that are going on. Talking about the future of applications is a far, far more difficult thing, and it falls in the area, I believe, called artificial intelligence. What can machines do that we normally do and we'd like to have machines do? Now, in this field, which I'm taking up the next 2 lectures, next 3, I devoted to that, we're trying to find out the question of what machines can do for us. Now, many people have tried to get, when can machines replace us? Well, there are some jobs I would like to see replaced, which are physically very dangerous. But in general, I have always tried to concentrate on what can machine and man do together. It's not a question of what can machines do that we can't or what do we do that machines can't. It is a basic problem, what can machines and us together do? That's the real problem. And so to do this, we have to look at what kind of things have been done in this area of thinking. A very glib way of saying the whole problem with AI, artificial intelligence, is can machines think? It's a very nice way of phrasing it. It isn't a total thing. Now, it's been evaded by some very good experts. Turing, when presented with a problem, said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll put at the end of a teletype a human being and another one, I'll put a computer. And if you, at your end, cannot tell one from the other, the machine must have been thinking. Well, that's not decent science. It's a very, very difficult task. And normally, science begins by doing the simplest problems. Thus, Galileo drops simple things. In fact, he ran down a slope slowly. He didn't drop down a slope like that, attenuating gravity, so he had better timing. Normally, science begins with something close to the simplest program or problem you can do and work your way up. Thus, in trying to approach artificial intelligence once, I started to ask myself at night, as I went to bed and put my head in the pillow, what would be the smallest program which I would consider thinking, such that if I cut it in half, neither piece would. Not what is the biggest program, but what is somewhere near the least that you will accept as thinking. After a year, which means probably 200 dice out of the year, I actually did start thinking about this until I fell asleep, I had no answer. There's one obvious thing to do, as I said, must be the wrong question. I don't know. I leave it to you to think about for some time now. If you think machines can think, and you think you know what thinking is, what is something near the least that you regard as thinking, that you would accept? I may have told you, I tend to get ahead of sometimes these things. There are people who get around it by making strange definitions. And the power of definitions is very, very great. The difficulty is, fundamentally, is You want a definition that you can think. And you don't want any questions, can you think? Because I can always raise the question, is there intelligent life on Earth? And you'd be hard put to prove it. But you don't want that definition. You want a definition, because of your ego, that you can think. Well, what is it that is that you can think? And how small an activity, not how big a one, but how small a one, will you accept as thinking? That's one of the ways of approaching this field of artificial intelligence. It's a very, very vexing one. It is cursed by a large number of wild claims. Almost all the leaders in artificial intelligence have made wild claims. For example, probably early 50s, several very good men at RAND said, the chess champion of the world will be a computer within 10 years. Well, the chess champion of the world is still not a machine, but we are closing in on the matter, and it would be dangerous to assert that before the year 2000, machines will not be able to beat humans playing chess. They have certainly demonstrated a while back on backgammon. The story goes, I've heard, that somebody's backgammon program took on all the people who came up, leaders in a tournament in Italy, and beat them all flat. Games like Go, which is a Chinese game, popular, or Japan too, it's much harder to play. The game is so simple that it's very, very hard, and there have not been very good successful programs there, but an amazing number. My friend wrote a good checker program, which I'll discuss next time, because checkers are thought to be easier than chess. And we looked at the problem, we've done a great many things we don't know yet, and the problem will not go away. If you believe machines can think and do anything at all, you are almost bound to fall on your face sometime or other. Like quite a few of my friends, back programs are going to translate from one language to the other. They really are not viable to this day. You can have them do a little bit, but it doesn't work. I'll tell you simple reasons why. You might think it's going to translate word for word. It works for a while. But consider the following conversation with my wife and myself. I said to her, we're not going shopping today, are we, dear? She says, no. Meaning, yes, we are not going. How will you ever recognize double no's meaning no or double no's meaning yes? I don't know any formula to help you. Some situations go one way, some go another. I might as well tell you the last one and quit. It's one of my favorite ones about my wife. We had a house in New Jersey with windows looking right out on the garden. We're having breakfast. And she says to me, Dick, it's raining out. I look at her and say, does that dumb dame think that I can't see this rain? What the hell goes on? I think some more. And I say to myself, what she really said was, I've had my second cup of coffee, I'm fit to talk to you. Right? I was so enchanted with that discovery that much of the day at Dell Labs, I spent in watching, wherever I could, at lunch, in the halls, casual conversation, how often what was said, if interpreted literally by a machine, was not what was being communicated. Think of it, you pass by all. How are you? They just don't want to know. They don't want a long list of aches and pains. It's something else. It's acknowledgement that the person exists and so on. It's a symbolic gesture of some other type. Our language is loaded with this stuff. Our whole social fabric is filled with symbolic things which mean something quite different than what they appear in words. And this makes it very, very difficult to cope with language as we speak it when you want to get into machines. It sounds so nice, and so many people start it. Let's solve the whole problem by programming in natural language, and there won't be any trouble. The trouble with natural language doesn't work that way. How it works, the various theories we've had so far are all been shown to be very inadequate. They simply do not account for how we do it. And many of you have children. You must have watched how children learn a language they sure didn't explain nouns, verbs, or anything else like that, or any agreement of tense, or any of those things. We're never told them, and they learned to talk pretty well. Their chief error was being too regular. They spoke the verbs and other things, so they spoke too regularly. You had to point out to them, no, the plural of ox is not oxus, it's oxen. They tend to be somewhat more regular, but they somehow or other can learn a language knowing none. It's another thing, if I know a language, you're going to teach me another one. That's easy. You've got the first one, you play the second one. But how a child not knowing anything learns baffles me. Because if I point to a horse and say, horse, does the child think that's the name of the horse, like Charlie or Joe? Or does he think it's the name of a four-legged animal, a backboned animal? Does he think it's the color I'm pointing to? How can anyone ever get an abstract idea from the concrete? You can only see the concrete. How do you know what to abstract to get the abstract idea? How does that child know what to abstract and recognize? I'm talking about a class of horses, as you and I mean it. And you know as well as I do that every dictionary is circular. The first words define certain other words, right? You can't start from nothing and get any place. Yet, it's clearly observable, children can learn, it's clearly observable that ideas are communicated from one person to another, though we don't know what we're talking about. While I'm walking in this very treacherous field of artificial intelligence, and we're going to work out very slowly, but it's an extremely baffling thing because we don't know what we do, how we do it, anything of the kind. Yet, it's clear that there's somehow or other widespread mutual understanding based on a test I told you in calculus. I asked four questions. They seem to do as I would do. I conclude they have my idea. Do they have it? Just go ahead and prove it, isn't it? So I see you on Friday at 3, right? Okay.